We have spent the last 3 weeks in a sermon series where we have been looking at the relationship between the prophets and the kings in the Old Testament, between the men invested with power and the people that God called to speak truth to power. And what I suggested last week is that as the church, being the body of Christ, we have a prophetic role. We have a prophetic ministry, which means, like the prophets of old, we are called to be speaking on behalf of God. Meaning that sometimes we will be the ones required to say the things out loud that are not popular, things that other people may not want to hear. So, as I've been thinking about this, as I've been contemplating this prophetic role of the church, I've been asking myself a question that, well, frankly, the evangelical movement, broadly speaking, has been asking for a very long time. In fact, it's one of the central questions, I would say, that we ask. What is the relationship between the church and the world? What is exactly the nature of the relationship between church and the world, church and culture, churches and the power structures and the culture we find ourselves embedded in? What does that exactly look like? And there's all sorts of answers out there. There are conferences every year completely devoted to this question. There's been a lot of ink spilled in a lot of books trying to come up with the answer to that question. What is our relationship to the broader world and culture? And so what I've been asking myself as I've been reading through all of these stories of prophets and kings is, if the church is called to a prophetic role, a prophetic ministry, do these stories about the relationships between prophets and the kings and the people that they were called to speak to, do those relationships tell us anything about what our relationship to the world and broader culture should look like? Does it make sense? And as I've been thinking about that, the preliminary answer I've come up with is, I don't know. Because these relationships between prophets and kings, well, they're complicated, aren't they? They're not always so straightforward. Sometimes they're just plain weird. You can see this in the prophet and king we looked at last week, right? King Ahab and Elijah. And their relationship, especially on the front end, right? It is very clearly confrontational. They don't get along. I mean, Ahab, what the Bible says about him was that he was the worst king Israel had had yet. I mean, all the kings that had gone before him were bad enough. But he was even worse than they are. The guy's just absolutely the worst. And he marries this woman named Jezebel, and she kind of pushes him to more and more evil and Baal worship. And together they begin killing off all of the prophets of the Lord. And the ones that are left are like out hiding in caves. And then Elijah says, hey, it ain't gonna rain. It's a very confrontational relationship leading all the way up to Mount Carmel. You remember the story, hopefully. Mount Carmel is where Elijah calls down fire from heaven. And all the people of Israel say, ah, Yahweh is God, Yahweh is God. And then they kill all the prophets of Baal. That story. Very confrontational relationship. And yet after Carmel, there seems to be a change in the relationship between the king and the prophets of Yahweh. Because after Carmel, you see Ahab being confronted on three different occasions by prophets of Yahweh. None of them are named. And before he was trying to kill him, but now it seems they can just walk right up to him and talk to him and deliver the message of the Lord. The first two are pretty positive messages, and so maybe that's why he doesn't, you know, try and grab them and kill them. Israel at this point in history has been in a protracted conflict. I mean, just a constant state of war with the nation of Syria. And these two prophets come to Ahab and say, good news, you're going to defeat the Syrians. Well, who doesn't want to hear that? And this is exactly what happens. In the second battle, Israel actually captures Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. But Ahab makes a judgment error. He captures the king, but instead of putting an end to the conflict by putting an end to the king, he lets him go. And so another prophet comes to the king in disguise and tells the king, you weren't supposed to let him go. Yahweh had given him to you for a reason, and so now it is your life or his. Now that's the sort of comment that if you make to a king, you might expect it could cost you your life, and yet we don't see that happen. So something about the relationship has changed. It's not a fixed thing, it's in flux. Elijah does not come back into the story until after the story of Naboth and his vineyard. Jezebel and Ahab conspire together to kill the neighbor of the king so that they can take his vineyard. And finally, God has had enough of this king's wickedness. And so Elijah shows back up on the scene. And Elijah never says anything nice to Ahab. So when Ahab sees him, he says, ah, so you have found me, O my enemy. What a nice greeting. Elijah says, yeah, I found you. And the Lord's fed up with your wickedness. He's going to put an end to you and an end to your house. And Ahab does something that we might not expect. He rips his garments. Now, in the ancient Middle East, if you ripped your garments, it was a demonstration of very serious emotion. You were very distressed. He rips his garments, he puts on sackcloth, burlap, which is uncomfortable, and he goes around just dejected and down. And because Ahab does something surprising, then God does something surprising. God says to Elijah, hey, have you seen how Ahab humbled himself before me? Because he's humbled himself, I will not bring ruin in his lifetime. Really? Really? Because this guy is literally the worst. And if I'm the judge, if I'm God, I'm like weighing this out. I'm like, okay, you've got one act of humility, one act of contrition against all of this evil. It doesn't even come close to balancing in the scales. But that's what God does. These relationships are not simple. They're confusing sometimes. And if you think that's a strange relationship, how about the relationship between King Ahab and Jehoshaphat? You know him? Jehoshaphat is the king of the southern kingdom of Judah, with Jerusalem as the capital. So Ahab has Israel in the north, and Jehoshaphat has Judah in the south. And for a while after the separation of the kingdoms, they didn't get along, but Jehoshaphat, he makes peace with Ahab. And in fact, he makes much more than peace with Ahab. He gets downright friendly with him. Which again, excuse me, which again is kind of a strange deal, because what the Bible tells us about Jehoshaphat is that he was like his father Asa, who was like King David. They followed the Lord wholeheartedly. This was a person who is radically committed to Yahweh and serving only Yahweh. And he gets really, really friendly with the king who despises Yahweh and wants to serve everybody but Yahweh. And if you say, well, how do you know they were real friendly? Well, they spend a lot of time together. That's evident in the text. And Ahab gives his daughter to be married to Jehoshaphat's son. And Ahab and Jehoshaphat, they each have a son, and they give their sons the same name. They name both of their sons Jehoram. And this is really, really fun, because you're reading through 2 Kings, and it's saying, well, this king was the king of this kingdom, this king was this king of this kingdom. So you have two kings that have the same name that govern different kingdoms at the same time. And if that wasn't bad enough, in Hebrew, you can have a different form of their name. It can be either Jehoram or Joram, and they'll use different forms of the same name at the same time to talk about two different kings. Are we all thoroughly confused? Okay. These kings were really, really close. And so one day, Ahab says to Jehoshaphat, you know, the Syrians have taken Gilead. I think we should go take the land back. Will you come fight a battle with me? And Jehoshaphat says, sure, I'll come with you. I'm as you are. My soldiers are as your soldiers. And they do what kings typically did in that day. Before they went into battle, they summoned a bunch of prophets to tell them what the will of the gods were, whether they would succeed in battle or not. So they're sitting there, and all these prophets are saying, oh yes, you'll be successful, things will be fine. And Jehoshaphat says, you know, listen, this is nice, but isn't there a prophet of Yahweh that we could inquire of? And Ahab says, yeah, there's a prophet of Yahweh, but I hate that guy because he never says anything nice about me. And Jehoshaphat says, well, you shouldn't say that. Bring him on in. So they do. They go out and they get this prophet named Micaiah and they bring him in. And it's a really interesting story. You should take some time and read it yourself. But at the end of it, Micaiah says, no, you're not going to succeed in battle. The Lord has shown me Israel scattered across the hills. And by the way, all these other prophets have been lying to you because the Lord put a deceitful spirit in them. And Ahab says, see, I told you he never says anything nice. And so for Micaiah's trouble of being called in before the king, he gets slapped in the face by one of the other prophets, and Ahab has him locked up. And here's where the story gets really, really weird. If anybody's going to listen to the prophet of the Lord, speak the word of the Lord, you would imagine it's Jehoshaphat, the king, who professed to worship the Lord. But he doesn't. He just ignores the word of the Lord, and he goes into battle anyhow. The relationships between the kings and the prophets are complicated. They don't always make a lot of sense. And so this is the battle where Ahab perishes. He is eventually followed on the throne by his son Ahaziah. He has a very short reign, only 2 years. He has a fall, dies of his injuries, and ultimately he is followed on the throne by his son Jehoram that we've already talked about. So Ahab is succeeded by Jehoram, and the prophet Elijah is succeeded by the prophet Elisha. So after Elijah's taken up in a chariot of fire, you get several chapters in 2 Kings that is just a series of stories detailing the ministry of Elisha in all different ways. And what's really interesting about chapters 5, 6, and 7 is that in probably the most famous of the stories, the king of Israel shows up as a character, but he's never actually named. It's kind of surprising in a book that has the name 2 Kings. It's a book that's supposed to tell you about the kings, but it's really talking about Elisha and doesn't even bother to name him. Now, chronologically, Jehoram's really the only option for, so why don't we just name the king? I don't know. He's not named. But the way that the stories are told makes one stop and wonder what exactly the nature of the relationship between the prophet and the king was. The first story I want to look at this morning, it's the story of Naaman the leper. Now remember, Israel and Syria have been at war for years and years and years. The enemy general, Naaman, gets leprosy. And at that time, leprosy is a death sentence. But Naaman has a Hebrew slave girl because the Syrians would frequently come into Israel. They would raid the nation. They would capture people. The people would become slaves. And this young girl says to her master Naaman, well, you've got leprosy. There is a prophet in Israel who can heal you. So Naaman goes to the king of Syria, the enemy, and he writes a letter to his enemy, the king of Israel, and Naaman goes walking right into the capital city with a letter to the king, and the king of Israel gets the letter, reads it, says, here's Naaman, your sworn enemy, my general, he's got leprosy, how about you heal him? That doesn't make a lick of sense. And the king again gets upset, rips his robes, because he just assumes that, you know, the king of Syria is looking for a fight. And somehow Elisha hears about this. One of the themes you'll pick up is Elisha hears a lot of things. He's privy to a lot of conversations he's not actually involved in. So he hears about the king's predicament, that the enemy wants his general healed of leprosy, And he sends word to the king. He says, you send him to me. I'll take care of the problem. And when you listen to the language, it doesn't sound like a servant speaking to the king. It sounds like an equal giving instructions to another. He doesn't say, well, if it pleases your majesty. He doesn't say that. He says, you send him to me, I'll fix it. Naaman comes to him. He has him dip in the Jordan, and Naaman is healed of leprosy. And you kind of wonder, whose side is Elisha on anyhow? Healing the enemy general is not a tactically sound decision. You'd let him die. It works out better for you that way. But that's not what he does. He heals the enemy's general. In the next story, Elisha seems to be firmly on the side of the king of Israel. You might have imagined that healing the enemy general would get you some goodwill with the enemy, right? Maybe the king of Syria would see his general come back healed and think, well, you know what? These Israelites aren't so bad after all. Maybe they're nice guys. It doesn't happen. They just keep raiding, they keep attacking, they keep plundering. Only now, it seems like the king of Israel has some insider information. Because every time the king of Syria tries to camp here or raid here or attack here, the Israelites are already prepared. It's like they know everything that he's going to do. Because Elisha has been telling the king. And so, understandably, the king of Syria is just outraged. He calls all of his servants together and essentially asks, which one of you is betraying me? Who of you is trading state secrets to the enemy? And their response is incredible, isn't it? They're like, no, it's none of us. It's that Elisha guy. They say it so nonchalant, like it's just common knowledge. Well, how does the king not know this? Oh, it's Elisha. He can hear what you're saying in your bedroom. How do they know that? Somehow they do. And then my real question is, if they all know this, why didn't they tell the king when they first found out? These aren't very good servants. They say, well, Elisha just hears what you're saying in your bedroom, and then he tells the king. Well, we need to get this guy. Yeah, he's over in Dothan. How do they know this stuff? It seems like they know stuff that their king should know, and he doesn't. So the king gets this great idea. We're going to send the whole army and go get him. Wait a minute. They just said that Elisha knows what you say in your bedroom. You think you're going to get a drop on the guy who hears everything you say? Apparently he does. So he sends his army to Dothan in the night. And when they wake up, Elisha's servant does what you and I would do if we found our little town surrounded by an invading army. He freaks out. And Elisha's like, man, calm down. Calm down. Because those who were with us are greater, more than the enemy. And if I'm the servant, I'm like, have you woken up yet? You need some coffee. There ain't nobody here. And so Elisha prays, God, show him. God, show him. Open his eyes. And he opens his eyes, and he sees the hills covered with chariots and horsemen of fire. A heavenly army of great host. And this is the amazing part of the story. He doesn't use the army. It's almost like he never even considered it. He didn't need to. He just prays another crazy prayer. The first prayer was, Lord, open his eyes. The second prayer is, Lord, close their eyes. And the whole army goes blind. And then this is where it gets funny. Elisha's got a good sense of humor. He walks out to the blind army and says, hey, boys, this ain't the city and this ain't the place, but y'all follow me. I'll take you where you want to go. I'll show you the guy you're looking for. He is the guy they're looking for. How do you march a blind army across the countryside? Have you ever thought about this? I thought about that this week. I just imagine, like, they got to all get in a line and, like, you put your hand on the shoulder of the guy in front of you, just walk. And he leads them all the way to Samaria, right? The capital city. What is the conversation of the guys up on the wall? Because Samaria is a heavily fortified city up on a hill. It is a strategic position. So you know there's guys sitting there keeping watch on the wall. And all of a sudden, off in their horizon, they're like, I think that's the Syrian army. So initially, do they panic? But they're not moving very fast. Something isn't quite right. And then they see the prophet Elisha's out in front. What is the conversation between Elisha and the guy at the gate? How does that go? How does he convince him, I've got the whole Syrian army. Oh, don't worry, they're blind. Open the gate for us. He says they're all blind. What do I do? They open the gate. And Elijah effectively infiltrates the city with the entire Syrian army. And they really are blind. And then he prays a third time. God opened their eyes. And all of a sudden they see, and they weren't where they were expecting to be. Presumably they're surrounded by whatever soldiers were in the capital city. There's the man they were looking for. There's the king of Israel. Nobody knows what to do. This has to be an incredibly tense moment. And the king comes out, and like nothing in his life experience has prepared him for this moment. Like, the invading army does not show up in the midst of your city, surrounded by your guys being led by a prophet. Like, these things do not happen. And so he goes to Elijah, and listen to the language of respect. He says, my father. That's a change in relationship between the prophet and the king, isn't it? My father, should I strike him down? Should I strike him down? That would be the tactically sound decision. You have the enemy, get rid of him. Elijah says, no, you don't strike him down. Let's have a party instead. Where does he come up with his ideas? I mean, when he's sitting on the wall of Dothan and he sees an army out there, he's like, I think I'll pray that they'll all become blind. That thought wouldn't cross my mind. He brings the invading army to the king, and the king wants to kill all of them, and he thinks, now let's have a party. And that's what they do. He wines and dines all of them at a great feast, and he sends them back to their king. And now maybe you're thinking, okay, the general has been healed. The army has been feasted and sent home. Maybe now we have gotten some goodwill from the Syrians. No, of course not. Get to the third story. Syrian king, he just don't give up. He brings his whole army and he besieges the city of Samaria. And because during a siege, you can't get in, you can't get out, they have run out of food. Things have gotten very, very desperate. They are literally selling garbage in the street to eat, and they are getting top dollar for it because people are so terribly, terribly desperate. And the king's out walking on the wall, and you can imagine as he's surveying the enemy army that will not let anybody in or anybody out, he's thinking, I fed that guy. I fed that guy. That guy ate at my table. That guy ate at my table. And now there's no food at my table. And eventually he snaps. He rips his garments again. Like, he's getting good at this. I wonder who's like sewing all his clothes back up. He rips his garments and he says, may the Lord do to me and more so if the head of Elisha remains on his shoulders. Well, that's a change in relationship, isn't it? Last story, he's my father. Now he's, I'm going to kill him. Maybe that relationship's a fickle, transitory sort of thing. Again, Elijah seems to be hearing things and be a part of conversations that he wasn't really a part of, because before the servant, who is either going to deliver a message or kill Elisha, it's not necessarily clear. Before he gets there, Elisha, who's sitting with the elders, says, ha, you hear the footsteps of the murder? Go block the door. Eventually, the messenger's allowed in, and Elijah says, relax. Relax. By this time tomorrow, grain and flour will be sold in the marketplace cheap. Cheap. That's a good word. So we have the story where Elisha can hear things in conversations he's not a part of. It's followed by a story where the army hears things that aren't even there. It says that the Lord came and And he confused the Syrian army. They thought they heard the sound of an army marching toward them. They begin to panic and they leave everything. They leave the food, the tents, the gear, the gold, the silver. And Samaria is delivered. It's a weird relationship that this prophet has with the king. Because sometimes you think he's on the enemy's side. He has the enemy general healed and he has the enemy army wined and dined, but then it seems like he's on Israel's side, on the king's side, because he's feeding them all of this tactical information when he needs it. And at the most dire moment, he brings a word of deliverance and it comes to pass. Whose side is he on? Gets more complicated. We know that Jehoram or Joram, depending on where you read it, he was another one of these wicked kings of Israel. The nicest thing the Bible says about him, he's like, well, he was a terrible guy, but he wasn't as bad as his dad. Ahab was really bad. He wasn't that bad, but he was still a wicked guy. Nicest thing it says about him. What we see in chapter 8 and 9 is, again, surprising. In chapter 8, Elisha inserts himself into the politics of Syria. He takes a trip up to their capital city, and as he's going, he meets a man named Hazael. Hazael is a servant of the Syrian king, and it's a weird story. You should read it. He meets him, and they have this weird staring contest, and they just kind of stare at each other until one of them gets embarrassed, and then the prophet starts crying. It's really bizarre. And Hazael says, why is the man of God crying? He looks at Hazael, he says, because I know what you're going to do. I know the wickedness, the evil, and the violence you will perpetuate on my people Israel. It's breaking his heart. He's very upset about this. But he says, God has decided you will be king in Syria. Strange relationships between prophets and people in power. Sometimes delivering messages that he probably didn't want to deliver. We find out that the next day Hazael murders Ben-Hadad, becomes king in Syria. And then in chapter 9, Elisha sends someone to go anoint Jehu. Jehu is the one that God has chosen to destroy the house of Ahab and to destroy Baalism in Israel. He also will end up being a wicked king like all the rest that went before him, but this is the one God has chosen. So Elisha's servant anoints him, and then he goes and he murders Jehoram. So sometimes the prophet seems to be on your side as king. Sometimes the prophet's feeding you tactical information. Sometimes the prophet brings a message that you will succeed in battle, that you're going to win, that God is with you. And sometimes the prophet says, no, the Lord is not with you, and you will not succeed in battle. And sometimes it seems like the prophet is helping the enemy, and sometimes he anoints the one who will be your very undoing. Strange, complicated relationships between prophets and kings. So I came back to that question. Do these relationships tell us anything, give us any idea of what it would be like for us as the church to have some clear vision of our relationship to the world and to culture? And here's what I'm beginning to think. I'm beginning to think that maybe we've asked the question wrong, or maybe we're asking the wrong question. Because when I look at the prophets and their relationship with the kings and the people around them, it's almost like they don't care. That their standing with the king is it might be a second or third order priority. It's not that big a deal. It's not a number one sort of priority. They're not that focused on their relationship with the king or with the people that they've been called to. The singular focus of the prophet is on God and delivering the word that he has given them to speak. And I wonder if that's where we've missed it. I asked the question, what is the relationship between church and culture? And that really is the central question of a whole nexus of questions and theological discussions. I ask it because I was taught to. Because that's the question all of us have been asking. But what if the solutions to the problems of the world aren't found in focusing so much on them, but on turning actually and focusing our energies and efforts at God? I wonder if a shift in focus may bring a transformation in perceptions. Do you realize why Elisha was so special, so different, so effective? It's because he saw things nobody else saw. And he saw them the way they really were. Everybody else thought they were perceiving reality, but they were not. He was really perceiving reality because he could see things that nobody else could see. He was the guy who heard things he wasn't supposed to be hearing. He seemed to be involved in all the pertinent conversations, whether he got invited or not. So you have a man who can see and hear things that nobody else seems to be seeing and hearing, and then all of a sudden he's offering up solutions to problems that nobody else could come up with. Why? Because he saw more. He was offering solutions that were actually beyond the horizons of the possible for everybody else because he had bigger horizons. He just saw more. It's not that he was necessarily smarter than everybody else. He just had access to a bigger vision of the world. Do we have that in the church today? I think the mistake we make so often is that we think we're the church. We're the people of God. So we've got the God thing more or less figured out, right? Jesus is my Lord and Savior, saved and sanctified, baptized, got all the boxes checked. And once you've got all the boxes checked and you've got the God relationship figured out, then you can pivot and focus on the mission of God and bringing about the kingdom of God in the world. And I've heard my pastor say it, because I have, right? We focus on the kingdom of God and building the kingdom and what Christ is at work doing in the world. What if that's not how we see? Because let's be honest. Has the church actually been, in recent memory, that effective in solving the problems of the world? Mm-mm. Have we brought to the table vision, information that the world did not already have? You remember, right? You know, we've said, like three times this morning, I believe that the church has a prophetic ministry. You realize, right, that the first job of the prophet is not to speak. It's not the first task. The first job of the prophet is to listen. Because until you have heard the word of the Lord, you don't have anything to say. And I wonder if we have lived too long in a church that's hard of hearing. I took all sorts of classes in seminary, and there's all sorts of training out there. But how to lead in the church, how to mobilize people, how to resource people. Would you be shocked if I told you there's no class that teaches you how to pray and listen? There is none. And I just wonder if we've got churches full of people that they haven't heard nothing. Some of them still think they got something to say. They ain't heard nothing. Of course the world doesn't invite us to the table to provide solutions to the problems. In our church, we have discipleship bands. It's one of our primary ways of raising up disciples. And these discipleship bands do a number of different things, but one of the things that happens in all of my discipleship bands is accountability. And one of the accountability questions we ask every single week, how has God been speaking into your life? What have you heard him say? And in every group, without exception, sooner or later, when we get really honest with one another, you will hear people say on occasion, I don't know what God has been saying to me. If I'm being honest, I probably haven't been listening. These are people who have already anticipated the question. It's already in the back of their minds that someone's going to check in on them about how well they've been listening to God. Can I suggest to you, I believe that this state of I haven't really been listening is probably the normative condition for most Christians today. And until we hear something, we will not have anything to say. That has to change. Some of us, if we were being really honest, doubt that it's reasonable to expect to hear from God at all. And if you really believe that, of course you don't even bother listening. Some of us, I think, might be afraid of what we would hear. That's probably somewhat healthy. And some of us just don't have time. Our lives are just too full. There's not enough quiet or calm or stillness. And some of us need to be taught how. But here's the thing. If I'm talking about the people in this room right now. If we are really serious about making a lick's worth of difference in this world, it has to start there. It doesn't start with mobilization. It doesn't start with me getting you all excited about some ministry project. And it doesn't start with giving and resourcing and all of that. Those are important things, of course. But until the people of God hear from God, what are we going to do? And what will we say that'll make any difference? Meaningful kingdom, eternal difference. I think nothing. Because I don't know about you. I'm not that smart. I'm not smart enough to provide solutions unless God gives them to me. I don't know what the answers are. I don't know what the answers are to my own problems, let alone the world's problems, until I hear from on high. I want to leave you with that challenge this morning. How have you heard from God lately? Have you practiced listening? Oh, it's hard, church. It's hard. But maybe today, you find 5 minutes by yourself, in between football games if you got to. 5 minutes. And you go to a quiet place and make a start. Listen. Don't say anything. And when thoughts pop into your head, and they will, trust me, acknowledge them, let them go, but give 5 minutes. Do it today. And then do it tomorrow, 5 more minutes. And if you're anything like me, the first couple weeks are going to be really, really, really frustrating because it's going to feel like I'm just a distracted five-year-old. I never hear anything. Keep at it. Keep at it. Keep at it. Because until we learn to listen, I believe my heart of hearts, everything else is for naught. But if God would speak and we would hear and we would do, that would change everything.